It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Today, reinventing fiction.
What I'm trying to do is to get away from all concepts we have. The concept of identity, the concept of quality, the concept of what a novel is, the concept of what a day looks like, you know?
I think what has always interested me is the way language can tickle parts of our imagination and bring a new kind of vibrancy and awareness to our lives that goes beyond what can actually be displayed on any kind of screen.
Are you tired of the old way of fiction? Is page after printed page of text just not doing it for you anymore? You could try Japanese cell phone novels, entire books written on a mobile in text messages. Or how about a Twitter story? Writers are experimenting with all kinds of new forms today. For example, take Sheila Hetty. She's a Canadian writer, author of a new novel called How Should a Person Be? And it's fiction, but the characters are real people. They seem to be Sheila herself and her friends. Some of their dialogue is from actual conversations that she transcribed. So what is this thing? Is it an autobiographical novel, a fictional memoir, or some strange new hybrid of metafiction and nonfiction?
I always just thought of it as a novel. When people started using the words autobiographical and memoir, it was kind of a surprise to me. But in fact, writing the book, I had thought of it as a novel. And even the idea that the character's name is Sheila and that the other character's name is Margot, that didn't happen till years into the process. I didn't even really think that I was writing about myself or any kind of creature that could be taken as myself until many years in. And when that sort of occurred to me, I felt horrified. So it definitely wasn't my intention to write an autobiographical book.
I want to give people an idea of what you're talking about. Is there a section you could read to kind of bring this to life? And maybe you could set it up for us.
So this is chapter 8 from the book, How Should a Person Be? And the chapter's called Margot Paints. Sheila's been commissioned to write a feminist play, and she's having a hard time doing it. And instead of writing, she tends to distract herself or preoccupy herself with socializing with her new friend, Margot, who's a painter. I worked on my play for several days badly. Finally, one night, needing to get out of my apartment, I picked up my computer and went with it to our studio. It was early on a Friday evening, and I was walking slowly when I heard someone call out my name. I turned and saw Margot coming down the alley. She was pushing something on a trolley in front of her, and as she got closer, I saw it was a tree, a baby tree in a pot. We hugged hello, and then I asked her if it was a tree she had grown. She said it was. Margot grew plants on her balcony, and she was really good at getting them strong. I was curious to know what her secret was. She told me she was going now to plant the tree in a friend's yard, a friend whose father had recently died. I decided to go with her, and as we walked together, we talked. Sheila, you know what? If we ever have kids, I really like the idea of trading babies. Margot, yeah, that'd be fun, getting pregnant together. And you're right, we'd have such adoring love for each other's baby. But it might be hard. Sheila, what, to give up your own? Margot, maybe. Do you think you'd prefer one to the other? Sheila, I think I'd have more fun if it was yours. Margot, yeah, exactly, you would. I think it's a great idea. I think I always want culture to work like that. I think it would be less emotionally complicated if I was raising society's child. But you'd have to sleep with someone who's really big with black hair. Sheila, no, because babies can be anything. Margot, but when they turn 20, boy, they laugh. When we got to the yard, I watched as she dug a neat, deep hole and placed the tree inside it. I leaned against the fence and waited until she was done. I said I would walk her home, but on the way to her apartment, we stopped in at my place so I could pick up a sweater. Inside, Margot pointed to a pile of papers on my desk, which were labeled on top with a black marker, Margot. What's that? She asked. Our conversations, I said. Margot was quiet. She went to wait by the stairs.
Okay, so did that really happen? Did you really record and transcribe that conversation?
I can't remember. I mean, I had hundreds of pages of recordings, and I edited them, and I wrote new things, and everything kind of got mashed up, like, with what actually was recorded and what I invented. So the whole book ends up being somewhere in the middle.
But so why were you doing this? transcribing and recording conversations with your friends?
I had just published and spent 5 years writing this book called Tickner. I'd just been spending 5 years at my desk alone writing a book without talking to anybody about it and just having this very closed process. When I started this book or started thinking about the next book, I really felt like I just couldn't work that way anymore. It felt sort of dead to me because I'd just come through it and I couldn't repeat myself. And I just became really drawn to these people around me, specifically Margot, who's a painter and had ideas about the world that weren't my ideas. And whenever I was at home writing, I just felt like this is not learning. Learning is talking to Margot. Learning is being around Margot. And I had to follow that. Like, I was just more curious about her than I was about being alone in my head. But I also wanted to write a book, and I felt like I was asking myself the question as I was writing this, is there a different way of writing a book? Is there a way of writing a book sort of not in collaboration in the usual sense of collaboration, but in the world with my friends, doing what I want to do, writing a book away from my desk? So I guess that's what started it.
And so what was your process? How did you do that?
Well, I spent a lot of time traveling with her and going to art fairs and walking around the city and taping our conversations and reading them over. And then a lot of time also just writing. I mean, I did spend a lot of time alone in my room in the end. You kind of have to. And I was watching reality TV. I sort of felt like I wanted to use ourselves in the same way that I felt like reality TV producers used the actors or the people that they made their shows about.
So are you saying what you wanted was to blur the lines between reality and fiction, or that you wanted to find a way to make fiction feel more real?
I wanted my book and my life to be the same thing. So I'm not sure that either of those things you mentioned were my motivation. I just wanted there to be one. I just wanted to sort of meld my art and my life. I wanted there to be one substance to make the book out of my life and to organize my life as though it was a book. To sort of like, let's say, to write documentary fiction or documentary like journalism about what was happening in my life. But my life itself was kind of a fiction because I would create these situations that I wanted to have happen because I wanted to write about them. But I didn't want to write about them using my imagination. I wanted to imagine them in my life and then write about them.
Whoa, so do you mean you would think, okay, what should happen in the next scene? Well, I think Margot and Sheila need to have an argument. So would you make the argument happen?
Not exactly like that. I mean, I didn't write the book in order, so it wasn't like this is what I want to have happen in the next scene. But yeah, I did make things happen among my friends. I did. There's an ugly painting competition in the book between Margot and this other painter, Shalom. And I really wanted that to happen. And I think that was one of the first pieces of writing where I felt like, oh, what I'm doing is something I've never really thought could be done, where you create a fictional scenario in your life to write about it in a nonfiction way. So where's the fiction in that? And where's the nonfiction in that? And I don't think anybody else knew that that's why I had encouraged this to happen. And by the end, all my friends understood what I was doing and were happy to participate.
Hmm. Could you read a bit just from the very beginning of the book?
Sure. How should a person be? For years and years, I asked it of everyone I met. I was always watching to see what they were going to do in any situation, so I could do it too. I was always listening to their answers, so if I liked them, I could make them my answers too. I noticed the way people dressed, the way they treated their lovers. In everyone, there was something to envy. You can admire anyone for being themselves. It's hard not to when everyone's so good at it. But when you think of them all together like that, how can you choose? How can you say, I'd rather be responsible like Misha than irresponsible like Margot? Responsibility looks so good on Misha, and irresponsibility looks so good on Margot. How could I know which would look best on me? I admired all the great personalities down through time, like Andy Warhol and Oscar Wilde. They seemed to be so perfectly themselves in every way. I didn't think, those are great souls, but I did think, those are some great personalities for our age. Charles Darwin, Albert Einstein. They did things, but they were things. I know that personality is just an invention of the news media. I know that character exists from the outside alone. I know that inside the body there's just temperature. So how do you build your soul? At a certain point, I know you have to forget about your soul and just do the work you're required to do. To go on and on about your soul is to miss the whole point of life. I could say that with more certainty if I knew the whole point of life. to worry too much about Oscar Wilde and Andy Warhol is just a lot of vanity.
Sheila Hattie, reading from her novel, How Should a Person Be? Novelists have always mined their own lives for inspiration, but no one's ever gone quite as far as the guy people call the Norwegian Proust, Karl Ove Knausgård. He just came out with volume 6 of his celebrated autobiographical novel called My Struggle. And the thing about Knausgård is, not only is he telling the story of his life as a novel, he also goes into unbelievable detail. He wrote 100 pages about trying to decide whether or not to go to a party.
I was 16 that summer. There were only 3 things I wanted. The first was a girlfriend. The second was to sleep with a girl. The third was to get drunk. Or, if I'm being totally honest, there were only 2 things. Sleeping with a girl and getting drunk. I had lots of other interests. I was full of ambition in all sorts of areas. I liked reading, listening to music, playing the guitar, watching films, playing soccer, swimming and snorkeling, traveling abroad, having money and buying myself bits of equipment. But in effect, all that was about having a good time, about spending my time in the most agreeable fashion possible. And that was fine, all of it. But when it came to the crunch, there were only 2 things I really wanted. No. When I actually came down to it, there was only 1. I wanted to sleep with a girl. That was the only thing I wanted.
So how exactly does Knausgård do this, blur real life into fiction? Steve Paulson sat down with him to find out.
Karl Ove, what you've done is astonishing. You've written thousands of pages about a life, your own life, where frankly not much happens, and yet it's fascinating. And my sense is one of the ways you've accomplished this is by not being too literary with your writing style. Was that a conscious decision for you, not to be overly literary as you wrote these books?
Yeah, that was very much so. That was kind of the major idea in this.
So how do you do that? How do you not be too literary?
I try to write as fast as possible to get away from, you know, when I try to write something really good, I spend a lot of time of writing, rewriting and rewriting drafts and I use a lot of time on the sentences and polish them and make them look good. And I didn't at all in this book do that. I did in the opening, the first maybe 15 pages, which is really, I really work through again and again and again. And I think that's the best thing I have written, you know. And it is clever in a way and beautiful. And when my editor suggested we take the beginning out because it's like so different from the rest, it's like you're starting up there and then you just dive into something much lower and simpler and more direct. But I disagree with him because I needed to have something in these books that were well written. So I had the opening only for that reason. So you can see that I'm doing this on purpose. You know, I know how to write, but that's not my ambition here to show you that I can write. My ambition here is to get away from being clever, getting away from making something, presenting something. But I just try to connect to something else inside of me, which is much more unsophisticated, much more banal, much more sometimes idiotic, you know. Because I think that's a good representation of life, at least my life.
So good writing can get in the way of representing a life, of being real.
Yeah, and then you have the question, maybe that's good writing, you know. Maybe that's quality. And I'm confused when it comes to a concept like quality. I don't really know what it is. I have no idea when I'm writing. I need someone to say to me, this is good, to be able to publish it or to be able to continue, because I can't see it at all if it's quality in it. So that's just a mystery. But I think it's what I'm trying to do is to get away from all the concepts we have, the concept of identity, the concept of quality, the concept of what a novel is, the concept of what a day looks like, you know. Just try to write through all those conceptions. I don't succeed, but it's that's my aim. You know, if you write 20 pages. I have never done that, but if you write 20 pages about a glass of water, something is happening, you know? There's something is changing in the way. So, yeah.
The amount of detail in these books is incredible. I mean, you spend 100 pages describing just getting to a party when you were 16, and you have long stretches of dialogue in quotation marks with friends, with family members, and supposedly all this stuff really happened to you. How accurate do you think these memories are?
They are accurate in the way that they capture the way I remember them, you know? It's not accurate in the way they really happen, because that's impossible. I mean, if you write about something 4 minutes ago or talking about something that happened 4 minutes ago, there will be someone there disagreeing, no, that didn't happen like that, you know? So it's really a book about my head and about what's in my head and my memories, kind of, it's the memory I'm writing about, not the real events in a way. Mm. And the dialogues are made up. I mean, I can't remember who said what in 20 years ago. That's impossible. And the details in that situation are correct, but I don't know if they were in that situation, you know?
Did you ever check with friends or family members to see if you were getting the details right?
I never did that, you know. That was another thing with this project. I shouldn't do any research. It should be all about what's in my head when I started. But I sent the manuscript out to many people before it was published, and I get reactions back, and some of them were saying that it didn't happen this way. But I still kept it that way because I wanted to be true to my memory more than to the real events.
Do you have a really good memory?
I thought I didn't before I started this project, but I think I do, but I think it's like it's hidden. It's like it's in... This is like a place that you have to get access to. And if you get access to that through, for instance, reading or writing, I think I have a good memory, and I think everybody has. I think it's just... I think everything is there. It's just a matter of getting at it.
So somehow it's through the act of writing that these memories come flooding back?
Yeah, it's exactly like that. And it is amazing in a way, especially with book 3, which deals with childhood, because it seems like my childhood was inaccessible for me when I started. I had some memories, but not enough to fill a book, you know. But when I started, it was like something opened up when I started to focus on the physics side of being, you know, 7 or 8. The physicality of existence, you know. So much running and climbing trees and doing all kind of stuff. There wasn't much thinking, which was a lot of doings. And when I started to write about that, it was like everything connected to that started to come back to me. Like how things smelled and I started to remember things we did, you know, we did that there and over there we did that and so on and so on and so on. So it was like a world opened up. And that was only because I was writing about it. Hmm.
It makes me wonder if these were actual memories or whether you're recreating something that you think was a memory, but it's basically an act of imagination instead.
It is. They are very close related. That's my experience, creating something and remembering something. When I wrote my first novel, it was like I'm using, you know, the exact same well as in these books. You have images, you have inner visions about things or landscapes, and some of them are exact and are true, and then from there you go on to something completely different. In this book I try not to go further, just to stay there. So when I sent the book from childhood to my friends when I was a child, which I haven't met since I was 13, you know, they sent me letters back and were saying it's so accurate and it's like you're giving us the childhood, you know, in a way, which was the only person's in... It was the only reaction I have had on these books that was very positive. But I think it was like... Yeah, I think it's exact in that way, the landscapes and the things we did and the atmosphere, that's kind of accurate in a way.
It's so fascinating. I mean, you're getting at something really profound about memory, which is that I mean, if we try to assess the truth of what you're talking about, you're really talking about sort of rendering emotional truth in some way. And, you know, if maybe some of the details didn't really happen that way, that doesn't matter in some way in terms of how, if it feels real or true or not.
Yeah, I think it's what I try to do is, you know, to make an impression. I'm not trying to retell my story, but I try to make an impression of how it is to be seven or how it is to be 17. That's the most important thing, that the reader should get a connection to that feeling of existence at that age. And I believe that is the same if you live in, you know, wherever you live, if you live in Asia or Africa or Europe or the US, being 17 is basically the same. The details and things are different, of course. The culture are different, but the view on the world and the way you experience the world and your longings and all that, I think that's basically is the same. Mm-hmm. I think we're much more alike than we normally think we are.
Now, it's worth pointing out that this six-volume autobiographical series that you've written is called fiction. It's called a novel, not memoir. Is that distinction important to you?
I didn't really give it a thought when I was doing it. For me, it is a novel because I'm not interested in my life as such, and I'm not interested in retelling stories from that life. This is a search for, you know, something, identity, or which is, this isn't a novelistic search, and I use my life as a raw material for that, and I use all the tools in the novel. I mean, there is a narrative structure, there is, it's like I could write 10 pages about 2 minutes, and then one sentence about 2 years, and I'm just throwing all these things up, and like you do in a novel, and it's all kind of things is stuffed in there. I mean, there is old song text I did. There is essayistic things. It is newspaper things. It is diaries. It is everything is in there. And I think that's the great thing with the novel. It's the only place we can do that. And it still is a novel. It still has a novelistic form. And it is not a memoir. I don't think it is. It's much more a novel. But if you could call it a non-fictional novel, maybe that will be close to where it is.
Karl Ove Knausgård is the author of the 6-volume non-fiction novel, My Struggle. He talked with Steve Paulson. So do you have any favorite boundary-pushing books you'd like to recommend? Talk to us on Facebook. And coming up, if you're looking for something new to read, writer Sarah Manguso has a suggestion. And if 8 volumes seems like a lot to write, how about a 27-volume work of experimental fiction? We'll talk with the author in a few minutes. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and it's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks. Writers on books they love.
Hello, this is Sarah Manguso. I am the author, most recently, of a book called Ongoingness, The End of a Diary. And I want to tell you about a little novella called My Friends, Mes Amis in its original French, by the writer Emmanuel Bove. Bove was born in Paris in 1898. He published several pot boilers in his early 20s under a pseudonym. But after he published his first short story under his real name, Colette read it. She liked it so much that she helped him publish Mes Amis in 1924. It was his first book published under his own name, and it was immediately read and praised by Rilke, Gide, Beckett, and other notable writers and artists of that time. Bove was instantly established in the Paris literary scene. He remained in Paris and kept publishing books. Under the occupation, he was conscripted to a labor camp, and in 1942, he escaped to Algeria. After the war, he came back to Paris in poor health, and he died soon after and was almost totally forgotten. The book immediately went out of print. I don't know of any other book that has swung between popularity and oblivion as many times in as short a time as this one. The plot sends its hero, an injured war veteran named Victor Baton, out and about in the socioeconomic margins of Paris. He goes between rooming houses, soup kitchens, and cheap restaurants, having little adventures with five people, one per chapter, that he hopes will become his friends. Among them are a small-time hustler, a businessman, and a suicidal bargeman. What I find exceptionally interesting about this book is the quality of his observations. He describes familiar things in a way that is once totally clear and charmingly, oddly new. He uses an associative suppleness and an efficiency that's almost never found outside poetry or even inside poetry. The first time I read the book, I kept turning pages to see what Baton would notice next. Here are a few of his best lines. The pipe of my little stove is tied up with a rag like a knee. The butcher's block is worn down in the middle like a step. On the mantelpiece, three gilt horses were drinking a mirror in a gilt trough. The book also contains one of my favorite passages about the nature of autobiographical memory. Quote, just as I hardly ever sing the songs of my childhood in order not to blunt the memories they evoke, so I only think about my life as a soldier when I cannot do anything else. I like to keep a store of memories in my mind. I know it is there. It is enough for me.
Sarah Manguso recommends Mes Amis by Emmanuel Bove. You can find more bookmarks and an interview with Manguso on our website at ttbook.org. How long can a novel be? Is there or should there be an outer limit? Samuel Richardson's Clarissa is 1,500 pages. Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged clocks in at about 1,000. But Mark Danielewski is working on a 27-volume novel. It's called The Familiar, and the first installment is just out, 800 pages, about a 12-year-old girl who finds a kitten. Danielewski is kind of a poster boy for innovative fiction. His debut novel, House of Leaves, was full of multiple layers, strange typography, footnotes inside other footnotes. The critics loved it, and it's got a huge cult following. And now he's back with, well, here's an example. It's narrated by a 12-year-old girl who's living with epilepsy. Her name is Xanther.
Dr. Potts never made Xanther feel punished. And eventually the consequences of this really sank in, Xanther getting the drift that these were her 50 minutes, and she could trust him for the most part, even if she had no idea why the most part or even what the not most part was, parts which made no difference if she got right to it, like she did today, following early advice by Dr. Potts. Try telling me first the thing that is most difficult to tell. I will help you. Or if not that, then ask me a question that is most difficult to ask, and I will help you. So Xanther went right to the raindrops, the number that said there was a number, even as it hit a number that was no number, and how it had made her feel. She even explained how her friend Clay has a brother named Phineas who is brilliant but fears dolphins, or not the dolphins, but how many dolphins there are, because his fear is also all about counting, because when you see three dolphins playing in the waves, that means there are really like nine with the rest under the waves. And if you see like a lot, like 27, there are really like 243. And that's just when we're talking about dolphins. What if we're talking about bad things like counting crimes? And then your mind really heats up and keeps heating up until it might turn into sticky, smelly smoke. Xanther told Dr. Potts, and this part was really difficult, how Clay thought his brother was crazy and needed to get back in a hospital again. Phineas had already tried to kill himself twice. Like Xanther, he's left-handed. Clay's called him schizo. Actually, more than that, Phineas can solve a Rubik's Cube in under 5 minutes.
That's Mark Danielewski reading from his new novel, and here is his conversation with Doug Gordon.
Mark, you've said that the familiar will show that the novel can stalk, take down, and devour the television series. Is that a fair quote?
That's a fair quote.
Do you see television, film, and the internet as competition?
Certainly. I think, you know, all forms of media are means of distracting one from reading. And certainly a lot of young people that I encounter outside of bookstores or readings are not reading. But I think what has always interested me in is kind of bringing forth not only what the book itself is capable of doing, the novel, the pages, the codex itself, but actually the way language can tickle parts of our imagination and bring a new kind of vibrancy and awareness to our lives that goes beyond what can actually be displayed on any kind of screen. And so the interaction that Xanther has with a rainstorm is very important for a lot of reasons. In one sense, it's a storm, and another sense, it's the storm of questions that she has that literally in some ways become kind of a seizure of information. She's the heart of the story, especially for me, because she's so brave in facing that deluge that she is in the midst of. And isn't that where we all are right now, that we are dealing with this deluge of information, whether it's Twitter or texts or phone calls or websites or however we sort of traffic information now, frequently more and more impersonally, though it's guised as this kind of personal interaction. And the big question that many of us are afraid to ask is, how do I navigate this? Do I just put on a pair of galoshes? Do I grab an umbrella? What are those things? Or am I actually going to drown in that storm? Sure, it's about Xanther going to get her surprise, a little creature that is way beyond the reach of any form of this kind of technology that we're so obsessed with. But it's also how to manage this flood of information that we are faced with.
This being one of your books, it is not a traditional book by any stretch of the imagination because there are different fonts corresponding to the different characters. There are illustrations. The text takes a variety of forms. It often resembles concrete poetry. One of my favorite parts is that double-page spread you have on pages 68 and 69 where you've created this rainstorm with the layout of the words and multiple raindrops that are made out of the words. How many raindrops? And the sections are color-coded according to the various protagonists. Anything I'm missing?
You're doing a pretty good job.
Thank you. So that raises the question that with all of your work, it seems, and especially with The Familiar, it seems like you're really trying to expand the possibilities of what a novel can be and the forms that the book as a physical object can assume. Is that fair to say? Is that a goal, something that drives you in your work?
Well, the aim is never, okay, let's produce the most amount of pages or the most amount of colors or the most amount of scattered text. You know, it's not that simple. While working with Xanther, while working with her father Anwar or her mother Astaire, they bring to life a certain kind of language. They bring to life a certain kind of color. You know, they have a certain kind of voice. As you know, I've been doing this now for 15 years, at least in the public eye. And when House of Leaves came out, you know, everyone said, well, this is just nonsense and well, this is just different fonts. But, you know, it quickly became apparent by readers that these design elements help locate you quickly within the character. You immediately know you're with Luther or you're with Jing Jing in Singapore, and you begin to visually associate who they are by the language that they use and that is visualized within the book. So by following their personalities, their impulses, their narratives, it begins to create the structure which is the end result that you have before you, or the end beginning result that I've been working on for 9 years. So here I've been working on 9 years for this thing that is still a work in progress. We're going to see what happens next, and then we're going to see what kind of readership develops around it. Are there readers out there that will support such a project? Or will it be, like many a television show, canceled long before it reached its dramatic ending?
Mm-hmm. This idea of readers is interesting because in light of the fact that you have said that your books are not CD players, they're instruments, and a reader has to be willing to play them. That's a very appropriate analogy, it seems to me, because you have to learn how to read your books in the same kind of way that you have to learn to read music. Are you concerned that potential readers are going to be scared off by your approach?
It's certainly possible, but my adage has always been never underestimate the reader, and the readers actually have never let me down.
Yeah. How experimental can a novel be? Do you think there are limits?
We're going to find out, aren't we?
Yeah. Yeah, we are. Do you think that you have to rein in some of the creative impulses in order to make sure that you have some readers? Or can you just let your imagination run wild and go as far as you want and just hope that you'll get some to come along for the ride? Is that something you think about?
Experimental is tricky because it tends to sort of suggest that things are randomly placed and that their occurrences are so ambiguous that one can't really make sense of them in a way that creates a sort of a transportable idea or a certain dramatic linear experience. But in fact, this book is very linear. This book has very specific character arcs. It has very specific interactions. And in that sense, it's much closer to what a television show does in the way its arc is carried out. So I don't really see it as being that experimental. You know, I read the concrete poetry of the 60s, Apollinaire, you know, Faulkner's discussion about multiple colors for his books. These were like very, very early experiments that I'm actually implementing and refining, but they certainly didn't start with me. The question is, could they be used to harness something that was less abstract? Once you're immersed in the worlds, whether it's House of Leaves, Only Revolutions, or The Familiar, then you begin to see in some ways how formally organized it is and how much fun it can be.
Getting back to the TV series analogy for just a moment, because there is so much going on in this first volume of what is first of hopefully 27 volumes, I'm curious, are you going to start each subsequent volume with a TV-style recap, you know, previously on The Familiar?
Such a great question. That's actually what I'm working on right now. We're trying to figure out really what to do with the flap copy for volume two.
The creative spirit really runs in your family. Your sister is the singer-songwriter Poe. You've collaborated with her. And your father, Tad Danielewski, was a filmmaker. Did you ever share any of your writing with him?
Yes. There was a piece that I wrote for my father when I learned that he had cancer and that he was hospitalized. And I got on a Greyhound bus in New York, and I didn't sleep. And for 3 days and three nights or whatever it was, I wrote constantly. And at the end of this journey, I presented him with this story called Redwood, which is buried somewhere.
Can you tell me about when you presented that manuscript to your father in his hospital bed? Can you take me back to that?
It was actually at home. He'd come home, and it was a pretty upsetting moment because for me it was a gesture. It was a gift, and I think now I can sort of see it as kind of an absurd gift. But I wanted him. I don't know what I was thinking, but I wanted to present him with this thing that would be meaningful to him. And his response was, well, why don't you go get a job at the post office?
Oh, dear.
And it was so brutal at that moment. And, of course, I can see now that it was brutal also because, you know, the prospect of his death was amplifying everything.
Yeah.
But for me, it was him saying, I never want you to write again. I don't want you to participate in this. And I ripped the thing up. Entirely, just tiny little pieces, and I threw it in a dumpster. And then about 3 days later, my sister took me out to dinner, and she said, "How are you doing?" And I was really broken. It was kind of a near suicidal act. In some ways, it was a suicide. I was completely numb, and she took out of her bag this folder, and I looked inside, and she had taped that story back together. She had gone into the dumpster and found all those pieces and reassembled for me my future.
Mark Danielewski is the author of The Familiar. He talked with Doug Gordon. Volume 3 will be out June 14th. And that's it for our conversation on reinventing fiction. Coming up, the story of a country music album that was recorded almost 45 years ago, but never released until now. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. On our minds this week is the story of a long-lost country music album that's just been released 40 years after it was recorded. Country musicians Vince Matthews and Jim Casey recorded the Kingston Springs Suite back in the early 70s. It was backed by some big names, and at the time, Matthews and Casey were rising stars in and around Nashville. There was a lot of talk about those songs. But after their record deal tanked, Vince's career faded away. He died in 2003, but Jim Casey is still around, and Charles Monroe Kane caught up with him.
Well, tell me about Vince. What was Vince like?
Vince was a wonderful, creative person. He really was. He came from what I'd call a hillbilly background around Waverly, Tennessee. And in this little town of Waverly, Vince must have stuck out like a sore thumb. He loved Elvis. He was the only one at the prom when they had the prom and graduation. Vince wore a white tuxedo, so he would feel like Elvis when he graduated. Brilliant person. In my book, sometimes people would get that brilliance mixed up with his habits,
right?
Which back then in the day, and people don't talk about this much, but I'll tell you, Nashville was a speed town.
You say you're leaving Kingston Springs, ain't nothing here for you.
The town floated on pills, and at least they were pharmaceutical. It wasn't like what you have today with meth.
Right, yeah.
It really wasn't. If there's a good side to it, it was those, they were diet pills meant for fat ladies and musicians who never got to sleep.
And I hope you stop and see me, child, next time you come passing through.
The only time I ever much saw a motel room was in the afternoon when we would be changing our clothes. And then we'd do the show. We'd, get in the station wagons and head trailers, and we'd drive another 500 miles. And I liked to drive, and I liked everybody else to shut up and go to sleep. So I'd light one up and get them stoned, and I'd take a little something, and I'd drive 500 miles. I'm not ashamed to admit it.
Not ashamed to admit it. Now, during the midst of all this, there was some creativity going on, and you guys came up with a theme album called the Kingston Springs Suite. How did that come about?
I was writing for a gentleman named Jack Clement, who was inducted in the Country Music Hall of Fame.
Cowboy Jack Clement, right?
You bet, man.
Yeah.
Now, you know him well.
I
do. You know, call him the cowboy. And he was the cowboy, and his mind was so open to creativity. I thought that everybody was like that. I saw the openness and the chance to create. And Jack's thing was, we've got studios here. You guys go in and record. Find people to record. Cut your songs. Myself, I wasn't finding anybody that was real exciting. I tried one gal who I had dated over the weekend, and she gave me a tape, and I played it for Jack, and he shut it off half the way through it and said, forget about this. You've got to do something else. And I said, well, what about Vince? And I saw Jack's eyes light up because Vince, was a little squirrely sometimes, meaning out there, and probably it didn't help that he was taking amphetamines and be real excited sometimes.
Yeah. Woke up this morning, heard a little bird say, ain't nobody supposed to work on such a sunshiny day. Merry, 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 life is just a dream. Let's go floating and a loafing and a toking downstream.
Me and Vince don't work in the summertime.
Take me back. What was it like the first time when you and Vince were in that recording studio and they pushed record? What was that experience like?
We know anytime they push the button in the recording studio, it's exciting. And it should generate something more than what you're carrying up to that moment. The first time we started recording in the studio to record the Kingston Springs Suite, it was produced by Shel Silverstein. I'm sure y'all are familiar with his writing and his art and his poetry. He brought that same feeling to the recording studio. It was an amazing one. He wanted the trees and the leaves all around it, and he wanted funny characters in the sound. I can't explain it. Shel Silverstein's advice was keep it simple. He didn't want it to sound like an imitation of country music.
Right, right, of course. Do you remember what the first song was? Do you remember what that first recording was?
I think the first song we did was Laid Back Country Picker.
Uppers, downers, turned arounders, tuck me up, then lay me down. Then one day I found myself in this sleepy southern town. I'm not looking for no answer. Now I know I'd never find just a laid back country picker. We're the laid-back country man.
Johnny Cash, Kris Kristofferson, Cowboy Jack Clement all put money behind this project for the Kingston Springs Suite. Johnny Cash wrote some pretty amazing liner notes for the album.
He did.
It was very well supported. Despite all of that, this record was never released until like a month ago, 40 years later. Why was it never pressed and released? You were done.
At some point, we really lost the monetary support of and the business support of Johnny Cash. Not because of anything we had done wrong. Cash just kind of folded up his enterprise within weeks after we cut the album. Closed the studio, shut down their publishing for monetary reasons and the IRS and things like that. And I was still on good terms. I'm not so sure about Vince.
Yeah, how did Vince? I mean, Vince seems like a bit of a wild one. How did he react to suddenly his project not getting the light of day?
Well, he was very frustrated. Vince was a hard person to deal with when he was frustrated, like many geniuses are.
Yeah.
And he was a genius. I'd have friends that in the business that would argue with that. Of course, they were the ones that didn't go that route and are millionaires and wrote all their songs in an office as opposed to Vince Matthews and the hillbilly method. He called it the hillbilly tradition, where we would have to stay up for days at a time, driving all over, visiting people, playing songs, going to offices, being crazy. And then only after you had exhausted yourself and got your mind to where you couldn't, then you would write the song.
You know, Jim, for more than 40 years, none of your songs on this LP ever saw the light of day. That is, except for with one exception, Waylon Jennings. The Waylon Jennings covered one of these songs, and it was a huge hit for him. Somehow along the way, Vince must have sold it to him. What was it like for you when you found out?
I was at a party one night, and another guitar player was there, Billy Ray Reynolds, and I was playing this song, Layback Country Picker, and he heard it, and he came over and started playing it with me. And he goes, I know that song. I've played that song 1,000 times. He said Waylon opened every show with it, and we recorded it 3 or 4 times. And it was Layback Country Picker.
Because he's a laid-back country picker. He got a laid-back country mind. Hey!
Like, I got to ask you, if you don't mind me asking you a personal question.
Sure.
you know, Waylon Jennings, Johnny Cash, all these people, Shel Silverstein, all these people doing your songs, they've made success from them. The Kingston Spring Suite, kind of your opus in some sense, was not successful. Do you resent that at all?
It made me feel bad. It made me feel very unsuccessful. And it was something I couldn't talk to people about because most of them didn't understand the process of why something was successful or wasn't. And then when I started talking about Johnny Cash or Waylon, especially up here in Nebraska, or Waylon or Shel Silverstein, Kris Kristofferson, being my friends, they thought I was lying to them.
Wow.
Somebody making up. And so I just didn't talk about it.
And I may sometime, oh, but not as long as the robin sings or the river runs through Kingston Springs.
You know, I know your best, former best friend and music collaborator has passed away. What do you think of all this? What would Vince think of this?
I'd love to explore that thought because, you know, Vince, in his own town, there would be times he'd be ridiculed. He'd go into a bar or something, and one of these guys in there who was not a tenth, a hundredth successful as Vince ever was with what he'd produced would say something like, "Hey, Vince, how's that old Kingston Spring Suite doing? You got a record deal there? How's this doing?" And it was so hurtful to Vince. It was hurtful. And so his attitude was not great, but I know it would be now. I'd love to have him sit here, man. He'd run his hands through that long Indian hair, and he'd roll his eyes up into his head and flitter his eyelashes, and he'd tell you something brilliant to let you know that he always knew he was brilliant, and you should know that too.
Was last year about this time Melva made this glass of wine.
Jim Casey recorded the Kingston Springs Suite with Vince Matthews nearly 45 years ago. It's just been released. Charles Monroe Kane talked with him. To the best of our knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon produced today's show with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tungekar, Craig Ely, and Emma Roskowski. Special thanks this week to audio engineer Joe Hartke. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. As always, thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.